Welcome to the Class of 1987 podcast. I am your host, Tim Harkness. On this podcast, we will be speaking with members of the Yale College Class of 1987 about their lives, where they've been, where they are now, and where they are going. We plan to cover a wide range of topics and have people who represent the full range of our class's experience. The Class of 1987 is the best class that Yale College has ever had, and we're here to celebrate that. So sit back and listen to what your classmates have to say. Hi, and welcome to this episode of the podcast. I have our guest today is Melissa Bauman Ward, who is joining us from California. Melissa, welcome.
Hey, Tim. Thank you. It's really great to be here.
So, you know, usually my first question is something along the lines of what college were you in? But we were in the same college, the best college.
Morse College, because Yale is Morse, right? Yale is Morse.
Exactly. So just let's give the audience just a little bit of background. Where do you live now and what's your life like now?
All right. So now I live in the San Francisco Bay Area in the East Bay. I live in a little town, Walnut Creek, although I do make it to the big city now and then. I'm a lawyer, and I do corporate and real estate law, and I work with a lot of homeowners associations, and that is never boring, I can tell you that. But the more interesting thing about me, I guess, is that I'm a recent empty nester, and like many of us, I was kind of a boomeranging empty nester because of COVID. My kids left and they came back and they left and they came back. And so now I think they've left now. My youngest is a junior in college. And so I think that they're not coming back permanently, knock on wood, but it's been a thing. So I am kind of trying to figure out what my life looks like without all those short people or young people around and what, you know, what I'm going to do for the next step.
So how are you thinking about that? A lot of people are wrestling with becoming an empty nester. And I have to say that's something that, you know, Lisa and I are wrestling with. We have one more kid at home and she goes to college in a year. And I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around it. Like, how are you thinking about it?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a little bit of an extreme person, as some of you may know, in some ways. And so when empty nesting came on the horizon, I took it to the extreme. And I not only launched the kids off to school, but I got divorced after a very long marriage. And, you know, essentially completely cleaned out the nest, which was never the plan, but was kind of what happened. And so I think that, I mean, I don't know whether the end of that relationship, it had to do with a lot of things. It was very complicated, obviously. But I think some of that was us kind of looking around and going, hey, what's this next phase of life going to look like? And I think it really is a kind of profound transition, particularly for those of us who over-focused on the kids and the family to the exclusion of a lot of other things, because suddenly that focus is not there. I mean, the kids always need you. They're never going to not need you, and you're never not going to be the parent to them. But you can't rely on them for your social structure or for your entertainment or for just the things that you do during the day or to provide meaning in your life as to what it is you do and who you are. So it was kind of a big deal, really.
Yeah, it sounds like it. You just said something I find really interesting. You said it wasn't part of the plan. I always think of you from our days in college as a very organized person and having a plan. Yeah. What was it like to deal with your plan having to be completely redone now that we're in our 50s?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. And I think that my kind of excessive planning perhaps attempts to control or manage that which can't be managed. You know, it's been kind of a lifelong journey for me to realize that there are things you can control and things you can't, and to focus on the things that you can't control, you know, in terms of what other people think of you or what, you know, what job you might get or, you know, these kind of things. That's not, those aren't the important things. I mean, the important things are the relationships that you have with people or the things that you do that bring joy to your life. And for me, I had to take a good hard look at why I had focused so much on essentially everybody else to the exclusion of who I was. And so it's kind of a rediscovering and reconnecting with myself in addition to figuring out what to do.
That are for there me, any? What, oh, go ahead.
What to do isn't as important as the kind of essential question of, if I'm not mom to the kids full time, who am I? You know, if I'm not Robert's wife, who am I? You know, and you know, the answer is I'm me, and that's enough. But it took a lot of therapy, thought, and kind of time to get to that place, which it took a long time, but I'm glad I started to get there now rather than never getting there.
So I know that you, when we were in college, were in the symphony, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And do you still play?
I do.
And is that part of the sort of reconnecting with yourself? Are you getting back into music, or has music been something that's been part of your life since college?
It's actually been part of my life since college. Although, interestingly, I kind of let it go during law school. As you know, law school is a bit rigorous. So I wasn't playing at all. And a few years after law school, I had the opportunity to start playing both for a church I was attending and then eventually with the local community orchestra that I've been playing with for like 20 years now. And I hadn't realized what an essential part of my person it was to be participating in music and to make music and to have that be kind of a focus until I went back. You know, it was like, I didn't know my arm was missing until, you know, I somehow got the arm back in a way. And it did give a, you know, a richness and a community and just something I love to do to make music is just really important. So I've been doing that for a long time. And then, of course, because I'm me, I also got involved in like being on the board of the symphony and doing all that other side of things, which was kind of fun to be able to do my lawyer thing a little bit and make music at the same time. But
so I continue to do that. You're a cellist, is that right?
I am a cellist. Yeah.
And so what's your favorite kind of symphonic music to play? Do you like the romantics? Do you like Baroque? What's your jam?
You know,
jam is usually not the word that one equates with classical music, but I do.
Well, of course. And I do have a couple of interesting stories about that. But I mean, I like the big classical, like symphonies, you know, like, you know, your Brahms, your Beethoven, any of these things. I mean, they're just like, there's something about just the richness of the harmony and the just the sound, you know, and I don't know if you know, but you know, when you play a cello, it literally at times vibrates through your entire body. You're connected to the instrument, you know, and it's just to be part of a group of people making that kind of sound is really, it's amazing, you know, to be able to
right.
do that.
And so when COVID came, you couldn't be connected with people. Did you still find a way to perform or to be able to play?
I did a little bit. In fact, one of the most interesting things creatively that I did during that time was something that I had never done before. And it was to do a recording for a video piece that was going to be done. We have a local guy in town who has written, he's a composer, and he has worked a lot with the local ballet company. And he wrote a piece that was for this ballet company to dance to, and then for the symphony to play all the music that went along with that. And because it was COVID, we had to record each part of it separately, and then he mixed it all together to make this incredible video, essentially, which is the only way that we could perform and be together in doing that. And so, you know, to go in the studio and, you know, have the headphones on and I'm doing the thing, you know, it was super fun. I hadn't done it before in that format. I've been recorded before, but not quite that way. And then to see how it all got put together was an amazing creative effort. And it was kind of fun for me also, because typically when you play, you know, in the pit for a ballet or for a musical or whatever you're doing, nobody sees you. You're wearing black, you're down below, you're hidden. But the COVID format allowed everybody to participate in kind of a physical and different way. Like we could all be seen in the video and we were all heard, and you know, the dancers did their dancing, and we were much more partners in that creative effort than we would have been if we'd done it in the traditional way on stage with us kind of backstage.
Do you see that kind of thing sort of continuing? I don't know if I can even dare to say the words after the pandemic, but when it switches to an endemic or whenever life gets a little bit more normal, that highlighting of the individuals in this symphony, do you think that's a possibility?
I don't think we're ever going to go back to kind of this solid kind of place driven way of making music. I think now we've gone outside and we've gone online and we did those things a little bit before, but I think it just was so static for all of us to sit in one place wearing black with somebody conducting and the audience sitting in one place, static, listening. And while there's always some interaction in that way, it's a lot more dynamic when we use different ways of listening and playing and participating. And I don't think we're going to go back ever. I think it's going to be more multimedia and connecting in different ways. And I think that's fantastic. Like, it's so exciting.
So do you have plans to play any new pieces or with any new groups coming up?
Well, I have been thinking about that. And I think that, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with the I'm just a little cog in the wheel of the orchestra. And so one thing that I really enjoyed in the past was playing with smaller chamber music groups. And part of that's because it's so pared down and everybody is essential. And I like the sound and it's a fun thing. So I think I'm going to try and find a smaller group to play with that's a little, it's fun to be part of the big event, but something a little more intimate and a little more connected, I think would be fun.
So are there any pieces that you've never played that you have on your musical bucket list that said, no, I want to be part of that performance?
Oh my gosh. Well, that's a good question. And I guess I really don't. Right before the COVID, in the before times, we did a Beethoven's Ninth performance with the full choir that, was just kind of transcendent. It was just amazing. And so, maybe that was my bucket list piece that I managed to achieve, but there's a lot out there. And I think I like the idea of, kind of pushing out from my classical preferences as well. For example, I just went to the Greek Theater in Berkeley to listen to Yo-Yo Ma and his bluegrass band, Goat Rodeo, that's the name of the band. And, when Yo-Yo Ma plays the cello, it's like a different instrument than I play. He's on a whole different plane of existence with regard to that. But so fun to hear him and his bandmates explore like this iconic American form of music in a really interesting way, using instruments that weren't necessarily traditional to do that. And so I think that I would love to do that. And I have to say, I'm insanely jealous of the Yale group Low Strung, the cello ensemble.
That's super
there.
Cool.
And I was just like, darn, I wish I'd thought of that when I was there. Because, here I had this intense envy of all the singing groups and all the stuff going on. And I'm like, why did it never occur to me that we could have actually had a cello group that is so awesomely cool? Although I don't know if I could ever be as cool as those kids. But,
You could. Yeah, I know you could. I have every
maybe,
faith.
And maybe we just need an alumni Low Strung or something and, we could do it because our cello section was pretty great back in the day. And I think we have good
energy. We have a reunion coming up. You can always put people together. Just saying.
Well, I will bring my cello if people will play with me. How's Perfect. That for a promise?
All right. So let's switch gears here if we could. You've been organizing more Zoom calls during the pandemic, for which we were all very grateful. And I know some of the other colleges have been doing the same thing. Those Zoom calls are one of the silver linings about COVID. There have been a number of silver linings. There have been some not so silver linings, but as with everyone else, but that's a silver lining. What's been the biggest surprise or biggest joy or happiness that came from those Zoom calls? Because we still do them for those who are listening. It's on Tuesday nights once a month.
Absolutely. And everybody's welcome. Even if you want to hang out with a bunch of morsels and you're not in Morse, you can still come. We're good with that. I have to agree with you that the Morse Zoom calls have really been one of my top silver linings of COVID. Reconnecting with people kind of far away and all over and talking to them every month has been a complete joy. And the for me, the breadth and interest of what we talk about kind of epitomizes what was so great about Yale, because one of the things I loved about Yale at all was, unlike kind of growing up in a little town, Santa Rosa, where, you know, in high school I wasn't that cool. Nobody really was. I was kind of nerdy. Nobody was really into all the stuff I was into. You know, like at Yale, everybody was so into what they were doing, whether it was physics or philosophy or football or, you know, whatever it was they were into. They just couldn't stop talking about it because they're so into it all the time. And I feel like we kind of recapture part of that just excitement and interest in ideas and things and books and experiences and just ideas that are exchanged in our group, you know. So for us to talk about everything from, you know, our families and how they're connected, and our, you know, the difficult, a lot of us are kind of sandwich generation people at this point, dealing with aging parents and kids that we're trying to navigate that, or you know, hearing Rob talk about amazing books about, you know, the environment, or, you know, yeah, like
that was Rob Ragusa.
Rob Ragusa.
Yes.
So, you know, he always has an amazing book that he's been reading that he, you know, he shares with us, and he's all like, you've got to read this book. You know, it's about this thing that, you know, and I'm like, I don't know anything about that. But now that Rob has like told me, I want to know more. Like, it's so interesting. Or, you know, for Dan Singer to like explain about Bitcoin and Bitcoin art and like gaming and like how all this works together and like all this crazy thing, you know, it's things you hear about, but when people you know are actually involved in it, it's truly remarkable to kind of get a, you know, catch a ride on kind of something they're really excited about and can explain in a way that makes me excited and interested in it too. You know, I've just learned a lot about that.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've really liked about the call. And also, you know, your sandwich generation comment resonates with me. I mean, I have an elderly father. My mom passed away years ago, but my father is still around and trying to manage an 89-year-old who wants to stay in Florida during the pandemic was really a challenge. He is no longer right in Florida, and we now have him closer to us, and it's a joy to have him in our lives, but it's a struggle too, because he's no longer independent in the way he wants to be or used to be. And, you know, at the same time, trying to help our children become independent as adults, it's a lot sometimes. I have found it comforting to talk to other people who are going through the same kind of thing. Because it sounds Absolutely. Like you are too.
Oh, completely. You know, my parents are in their 80s now, and, you know, they want to keep driving and they want to keep doing all this stuff. And, you know, there are hard conversations that are going to be held. And it's a big comfort to know that we're not alone. You know, when I talk to Jen Freed, one of my freshman roommates, you know, and to you know, hear the grace with which she's navigating the difficulties with her parents and, you know, them moving out of their family home and trying to get care for them. It's just, it's amazing. And also, you know, you don't feel like you're isolated and the only one. And I think that breaking down the isolation was one of my favorite things about reconnecting on a regular basis with people who, you know, I don't have to explain my background. I met you like the first day of college when I was 17 years old. I mean, I was literally 17 years old, right? You know, so you have this commonality in your background that survives through time. And then as we all age together and go through these different phases, it does make you feel like you're not on that journey by yourself. And that's been an amazing gift.
Thanks so much for tuning in. I hope you're enjoying the conversation. Please remember that this podcast is being brought to you by the 35th reunion of the greatest class Yale College has ever known, the great class of 1987. Our reunion will be in New Haven, Connecticut, June 2nd, 3rd, 4th, and 5th in Pearson College. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the conversation. So let me just ask you a couple questions about the reunion. First of all, you know, are there any things that you really want to see in the reunion? Experiences? Do you want it to be purely social? Do you want us to tackle particular issues? Or Are there anything that you have experienced from past reunions you want us to make sure we recreate as we organize? And when I say we, I mean the committee that's working on it, and then anyone who wants to give input, because any and all input is welcome.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think to me, the most important thing is reconnecting with people. And I mean, aside from like getting to wander around Yale and like, you know, like relive our, you know, now we're at like old blues, right? This is kind of fun. We can kind of swagger around and you know, rawr, back in my day, you know, you didn't, you know, so, I mean, that's super fun, but I really like to see people, but I feel like without some sort of structure or activity, it's really hard to, you know, just happen upon people on the street. And I think that the thing I don't want to see, which I think we all agree on, is, you know, the panels that we had early on at our reunions that I probably not very kindly called people who are more successful than me, you know, that panel, you know. You know, I, you know, as you mentioned, I'm just not that interested in people's resumes, and you know, their careers may be fascinating, but it's not the thing. But I am kind of interested in the issues that we're facing, you know, together as a society or as a class or as a group. And you know, I was thinking about that, and you know, I think that one of the biggest issues of our time that's come about now is literally protecting our democracy, and you know, thinking about how do we protect and defend, you know, not only the Constitution, everybody you know, like, you know, we're both lawyers, so I know we're big on that, but how do we make sure that everybody gets to vote, and how do we talk about that? And I would be interested in some, not only learning, it's not really community organizing, but just you know, kind of figuring out how to address the big problems of our time. And we do have experts in these various areas in our class, right? So, you know, somebody who works on, you know, voting rights or community organizing in that way, talking about, you know, what we can do together with our friends and in our communities to make that happen, or people who are experts in infectious disease and working in community medicine, talking about how do we convince our friends and neighbors to care enough about each other that they need to get vaccinated and wear masks, and you know, because at this point, I think there's such compassion fatigue and anger at people that haven't done that. I'm just like, you know, like, I want nothing to do with you. You know, just stay away from me and my family because you're a danger to me. But that's not helpful in moving our country forward in a healing and positive way. So I guess maybe thematic issues, and then talking about how we can affect change as people who are, you know, just as a generalization, we're very educated, we're resourced, you know, at a minimum, we have resources of education and ability. You know, many of us also have resources of money and time and connections to our communities, whether it's our local community or our national community. And so I think one of the things that the missing link for me is that how do we move from the individual with those resources to making an influence in our community, and how to do that. And I suspect there's some people in our class that know how to do that, and I'd be very interested in that.
Yeah, I think that would be interesting. You know, the idea that we could work together using our disparate skills and bring them together would be good. The other topic I would like to be able to talk about are how gender issues have evolved since we were in college together, and sort of where we are now and where we should be going. And one of the things that the reason it resonates with me particularly is I wrestle with as a partner in a law firm, because I've got a position of authority. And so I think in the next 10 years, I'll be sort of at the maximum amount of influence I can have on my profession and the organization in which I work. So how am I going to use that time? How am I going to use that time to affect change, to represent properly our clients, but also do what's right societally and make sure that the profession is more fair and more inclusive to those who are in it than it was certainly when we entered. And what are the sparks?
I love that you brought that up, you know, because I think that, you know, when we showed up at Yale, women had only been at Yale as undergraduates for, I mean, didn't we celebrate the 15 or, you know, 18 year, you know, celebration of women at Yale while we were there? And you know, we were only in college for 4 years. And so those 4 years were all we knew about what it was like to be in college. But I think I didn't realize how odd and exclusionary and weird it kind of was to have a undergraduate college that was pretty close to 50-50 when we were there, that had this hundreds and hundreds of years of just patent discrimination against people based on their, you know, their gender, or looks like.
Yeah, and I think that it's interesting. I wrote in my about the fact that our son Matthew is at University of Michigan, starting as a first year this year, because my grandparents met as undergraduates there 100 years ago. I have their 1921 yearbook right here.
Yeah.
And so in our family, at least, and my grandmother was a rather strong person, rather saucy, and nice. A lot of fun. Yeah. And in any event, but the whole point is, like, there was sort of this expectation from the moment I was born that women were going to be educated in this family and have an equal place. And right. That certainly wasn't the case. There's a movie that I watched recently called Maiden, which is about a group of women who sailed around the world. And it was filmed in 1988 and about 2 or 3 years ago. You know, so it was watching the women do what they were doing on the sailboat and then interviews with them about what it meant. And just to see the casual misogyny that was thrown their way in 1987 and 1988, obviously we identify it because we saw it, we lived it. And you and the women in our class much more than I did, obviously. But I think there's still a long way to go. And having an honest conversation about where we've come and how far have we gone in different professions and societally, and what can we do given this stage in our lives and our careers, can we do to affect the change? So I know you have two kids, one of which is a daughter, and I have two daughters, and I would like their work world to be much more fair than the work world that, you know, our classmates went into. So
I actually have three kids.
Oh, you have three kids. I'm sorry.
I have three. I know. I have a girl, boy, girl. You know, I totally agree. And I think, you know, as a 17-year-old arriving at Yale, or anywhere, had I arrived anywhere, I just think you don't have the perspective to really understand or kind of soak in the ideas of kind of bias and discrimination. And it wasn't in the, like, we didn't talk about it then in the same way. It was just, It was kind of, well, we'll let women in and they'll be equal and the same, you know, and that's all we need to do, like move along, you know, like kind of deal. But it's a question that's really interesting to me because, like you, my oldest daughter, Katie, your son, you know, went to Yale also, you know, graduated a couple of years ago. So it was very interesting to me to talk to her and kind of relive some of the stuff through her to see what's changed, what stayed the same, like has there been progress on this issue or not, you know, what about other stuff. And you know, my daughter was a, you know, a STEM major, and I think that it's a little tougher row to hoe, you know, or you know, in that way, because you know, it's still predominantly men who are in those, a lot of those majors, except for some clumps of, you know, of science majors that women seem to gravitate towards. But she was still the only female person in math classes she took. And, you know,
our oldest daughter didn't, went to Tufts and graduated last, just in May, with a degree in math. And I was encouraged by the degree to which the professors, many of whom were women, encouraged her to study math and were really, really positive influences in a way I thought was really, it gave me a lot of hope for her. But with that said, there were a number of instances where she faced really just blatant discrimination, and I found it disheartening. And so that's why I think talking about how far we've really come and where we can go would be interesting. So
absolutely.
Now that our time together is nearing an end.
Oh no, yes, no, we could have gone on for days here.
We probably could have. We are going to enter the podcast lightning round. All right. So I'm going to give you a few questions that I have not told you about before, and we'll see. They're quick ones. So here we go.
Okay.
If you had to travel back in time, what period would you go to?
Oh my gosh. All right. I don't know. How about I go back to 1983, to our first day on campus, and let's relive it and do it. Let's do it up differently now that we know more.
All right. Good. What is the best professor you had at Yale?
Oh my gosh. Again, I love John Blum. He ended up being randomly assigned to me as my advisor at one point. And he was so, not only was he just amazing in his coursework and, you know, being a professor in the books he'd written, but he also was incredibly kind to me when my mom got sick and just really was a support and, helped out. So I'd have to give him a nod for being the whole person professor there. But there were so many rock star professors that were just amazing, you know, to see, you know, I Jonathan Spence and Gadda Smith and, you know, these guys that just were Vince Scully, you know, this, you know, I wish I could have taken them all.
Yes. So, what was the most important class you took to you?
Again, you know, I ended up doing a lot of Chinese history in my, so probably Jonathan Spence's class was really important to me. You know, that was a really, you don't have that kind of rock star professor kind of deal. And just to get a view into another culture and in a really unique kind of way, the way he approached history was unusual, I think, in a lot of ways. And so I think that was very influential for me. But my directed studies classes, much as I possibly on the list of regrets, I'm not sure, but I learned to write, and the care with which all of those professors took with me on those weekly papers, I think that's had the biggest influence going forward in many ways.
What is the most dangerous thing you've ever done?
I'm taking the fifth, man.
Okay. That is the most prudent thing you've ever done. All right. Here's a yes or no question. Should we bring 1980s fashion back?
No.
Final question. Sally's or Pepe's?
I can't choose. I was thinking about that. I can't. So both. Yes. Great. The answer is yes.
Well, thank you so much for spending the time. I am really most grateful, and I'm sure the classmates will, our classmates would really extend their thanks as well. So thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tim. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
That's it for today. Thanks so much for tuning in. This has been the Y87 Podcast, the official podcast of the greatest class that Yale College has ever known. We hope you've enjoyed it. If you have any comments or questions or would like to appear as a guest, please email me at timothy.p.harkness@gmail.com. We look forward to hearing from you.